Good morning. Welcome to the Waning Days of Shattering Myths, a program that has been devoted to those of you who have come to realize, or at least open to the recognition, that all of the world's political, military, patriotic media, and even academic institutions are corrupt. That the primary culprits are government and religious entities, but that mankind has foisted all manner of lies on his fellow man. And that as a result of this, the vast preponderance of people have been misled. I would say, as we have surveyed the territory, the turf under our feet, that the majority of people aren't so much misled by religion, although it's a stunning number worldwide, but are misled by socialist secular humanism. And they may not even know that they are manifesting socialist, secular, humanist, politically correct tendencies because it's been part of their entire culture. That's why Yahweh asked Abraham to walk away from his country, from the overall society of Babel, because it permeates everything from academia to the media to politics to the military to entertainment. Every aspect of society is just reeks of this notion that truth is vastly less important than is political correctness. Scott, you wrote some observations yesterday on the Black Lives Matter movement. Could you share those?
Yeah. Well, lately I've been writing down my thoughts. I want to be better at writing, and the only way I can be better at writing is if I actually write down my thoughts and then critique them and go about it that way. And so, and plus it helps me on my sports show. If I have a sports take, I write it down, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Here in Minneapolis, we just recently had a Black Lives Matter protest that shut down I-94.
Oh, my. Shutting down an interstate.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Shut it.
What a place to protest. Boy, that's whatever happened to taking your grievances to town hall? Not splashy enough, huh?
Not splashy enough, I guess. So I wrote this down, and I'll just read it. I'm a white man, so I know due to the subject matter, my thoughts will most likely be discarded. Nevertheless, I will share them. I have grown up with, have friends, and currently live in a community with black, whites, Asians, Mexicans, and various other races mentioned. In fact, if you drove through my current community, you would assume that I am the minority. Through athletics, my life has been enriched by black friends, who are as diverse and lovable as any of my friends who share my pigmentation. I see movements like Black Lives Matter, and I am fortunate enough to know not to jump to the All Lives Matter bull that gets spewed all the time, mainly because I don't believe all lives matter. For example, if given the chance, I'd eliminate every anti-Semite, pedophile, and rapist without a second thought.
Yeah, that's really a profound thought. That really is a profound thought. All lives don't matter. The lives of those who acted in France, they don't matter. Those who encouraged them, they don't matter. The imams who instilled fundamentalist Islam in them, they don't matter. They're worthless. So you're right. All lives don't matter.
Definitely.
Go ahead. Yeah, it's a profound thought. So all lives matter is the wrong answer because all lives don't matter.
No. And if you say they do, you're lying to yourself.
Or you're immoral.
Yeah, you're just moron.
Right. You've lost the ability to exercise good judgment. You know, a pedophile's life does not matter.
Not at all.
Doesn't.
No. I've also always been one to look at myself to see if there are any changes that I can make before I begin to start demanding others to change. Maybe it is because of this that Black Lives Matter doesn't appeal to me in its current form. Black Lives Matter was originally supposed to bring attention to a growing problem, black people being violently killed at an alarming rate. An even more alarming statistic is how many blacks are killing their own. Cities like St. Louis, Detroit, New Orleans, Chicago, and Baltimore have become borderline war zones. Every day you can open a paper in these cities and find more and more black people shot, most likely by another black person. Shouldn't these be the places that Black Lives Matter starts their movement? Wouldn't these cities and black neighborhoods begin the foundation for a better movement? Anyone can get angry, shout, scream, and disrupt societies, or disrupt. societies and parents have dealt with that for years. But to get angry and change what made you angry, that can only be achieved through actions that inspire change in yourself or your surroundings first. I understand that police brutality and excessive force is an issue, but it's a separate issue, an issue that every person in America can get behind. However, that's not the issue that threatens your communities the most. Those start within your communities, and that's where the change must begin. Again, this all stems from me and how I deal with things I don't like. I assess myself first before demanding that others change. I fear that how it stands now, your cries of Black Lives Matter will continue to fall on people who will only point out statistics that do not favor you, and not actually see the problem, or even worse, not be heard at all.
Boy, that's a lot of truth there. What's your reaction, Kirk?
Well, he's absolutely right. I mean, they've got the focus on the wrong part. Of course lives matter, innocent lives matter, and of course people who are the pedophile, the killer, the murderer, the rapist, their life has very little value, if any. So we always fight the wrong things. We're always fighting the wrong battle.
All right. You know, it is not politically correct to talk about responsibility, accountability, cause and consequence in the African-American community. You're considered a racist if you do. Now, you can represent Black lives, African-American lives, and be considered enlightened, but if you have African-American accountability, oh, you're a racist. But let's recognize some truths. The numbers are somewhere between 7 and 8 times out of 10 that if there is a conflict leading to a homicide between a Black person, man or woman, and a white person, man or woman, between 7 and 8 times out of 10, the African-American is the perpetrator and the Caucasian is the victim. Now, if it was 50-50, then you wouldn't, you know, you just have a problem with people in general. But it's not even 70-30. It's worse than that. So that's a serious problem. Second is that the bigger problem is that when an African-American is involved in a homicide, 8 times out of 10, that homicide was perpetrated by another African-American. And of those, the vast preponderance of them are because they are A, in gangs, or B, involved in drugs. The purchase or distribution of drugs, which really are not separate things. They're one and the same. Gangs fund themselves and have turf, and the whole gang mentality now is built around territories and the importation and the sale and even the use of drugs. I think the numbers, Kirk, go to why we are in this situation. So African Americans need to take responsibility for their community. It's way out of whack. They're killing themselves, and they're killing Caucasians. Now, why are they doing so? And disproportionately, they're involved in gangs. As per capita, their involvement in gangs, involvement with drugs is much higher. So, what are the most likely causes? I'm going to say, in my opinion, it's twofold. One is that the overwhelming preponderance, I think it's in the range, again, of about 80 to 85% of African-American children are born out of wedlock. No marriage, no commitment, no family. That ain't the way it's supposed to work. In fact, while it's possible that a woman by herself can raise a son of, or daughter of character, and it happens a lot, the odds are so stacked against them.
I would also say that's a problem that's happening throughout the country. I bet if you looked at single parent births and things like that over the last 15 years, you would see it increased across the board. Would be my guess.
Well, marriage is a dying institution in America, and children being born outside of marriage now is the majority. It is, I think it's about 60% of children in America are born outside of a married couple or family. But it's not 60% in the African-American community. It's much closer to 90% in the African-American community.
Really?
Yeah. So it's a. This is. If I were to give you a single cause, I would say that's the number one cause. Lack of a family devoted to the upbringing of that child, and most importantly, since most African-American children are brought up by a single mother, who is all too often some work, all too often though on all manner of government.
Subsidy.
Yeah, subsidies. But they don't have a role model that says, you know, it is it's 6 o'clock in the morning. It's time to get up. Got to get my shower going. Got to have some breakfast. Got to get dressed. Have to get prepared. Need to leave so that I'm at work, properly groomed, prepared mentally, at the right time. As a matter of fact, I ought to show up there early and be and set an example so that I can get promoted. And I ought to be devoted to that employer for giving me this opportunity. And that idea of day after day, setting that example, showing the discipline to make a contribution, they don't have. Now, I'd say that so second in the African-American community, and the reason that there is the problem is the overall lack of discipline to work. The great society and the great compassion that was promoted by LBJ and then by politicians ever since has been counterproductive. It's destroyed the work ethic. It's destroyed character. It's created people who are now dependent. And when you do that kind of thing, you actually take away an essential aspect of an individual's character, their motivation, their ambition, their just ability to function in society. And we've done it. We've done it deliberately. I think it's a consequence. So, Scott, I think you hit on something that's important. It is an extremely insightful thing, I think, Kirk, to look at what the Great Society has done to America. And the Great Society actually didn't start with LBJ. It was the brainchild of FDR.
Sure.
And it was FDR's programs that were the impetus for all of that. And it's gone from being in the 1930s. 0% of the U.S. federal budget. To now, entitlements represent about 75%. So we have become 75% of what the government does is entitlement based. And if you were to throw in the salaries of the people who are overpaid, underworked, you know, it probably gets up to 80% are entitlements.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we become. It's a wealth redistribution machine.
Yeah, at least in the 30s, they had work programs where people actually picked up a shovel and
yep.
trails or whatever in the all these national parks, which I
yep.
don't think they should own anyway, but regardless, they do. And
yep.
the artists were painting murals in the post offices and things like that. So
yep.
they at least had to learn how to fish rather than be fed.
Okay. Yeah, I would agree with that. I personally think that national parks are fine. National forests and national
land. They
right.
own an awful lot of land.
Right. Yeah, national parks and national is fine. National forests, no. Nationally owned land, no. And it's, you know, it's the majority of the area in the West is owned by the government. And I think that is really wrong. And, you know, if it were me, I'd shut down every military base in the country, too, and forfeit that land. But, you know, it's a million things plaguing the country. But when we came up with that entitlement mentality, and, you know, the rest of the world followed, not the rest of the world, because, of course, they didn't do it in China, the most populous country. They didn't do it in India, the second most populous country. They did not do it in the Islamic world. So it is a phenomenon of the West, of Europe and the United States, and to a lesser degree, much lesser degree, South and Central America. But they were only able to do it based on the illusion of money. And so along with the entitlements, it had to have a fiat currency system where money was nothing but a myth.
Yeah.
And the two together set the world on a course for absolute bankruptcy. It's you know, we've talked a lot about Islam, and I want to make one more comment about Islam before we switch gears. But the fact is that in America, Islam is not going to be the factor that destroys America. It's going to be, we're going to be bludgeoned by Islam, but Islam is not the factor that's going to destroy America. We're going to implode economically. And it's the economic crisis is so overwhelming. Whether it's the fact that all Americans are living on credit and that the average American has $250 in savings and owes almost $250,000 in debt, and that the federal government is operating the same way, it's irresolvable. The fact that we can't borrow money anymore, so we're using quantitative easing to create the illusion of being solvent when, you know, when you're bankrupt, when you're spending more than you're taking in and you have no reserves and no one will loan you money, you are bankrupt. I mean, that is the definition of bankrupt. So America, rather than admit that we are bankrupt, I mean, it's over for America. We created this illusion by creating the illusion of money to buy our own bonds with fictitious money. That's what quantitative easing is.
No, it's amazing, isn't it?
It is truly amazing. So what I want to talk about Islam is that Holliday said that that France was at war with the United States, but that France would not tolerate any hostile acts against Muslims. Now, in fact, I even think he said against Islam. So that would be like saying we're at war with Nazi Germany, but we're not going to tolerate any hostile acts towards Nazi Germany. We're at war with Imperial Japan, but FDR would come and say, you know, this is a day that will live in infamy, and we're declaring war on Imperial Japan, but I will not tolerate any acts of violence against Imperial Japan. I mean, that is what Holliday said. They're incapable of recognizing that the Islamic State is Islamic. And the very fact that they are bombing the Islamic State means that they're deploying hostile acts against Islam. Now, does Islam have it coming? Sure. Is that the right response? Of course not. But how could you say something that stupid? I mean, is he that stupid? Or is it just part of the illusion? Kirk, if I were to tell you that the Roman Catholic Church isn't Roman, that there's no correlation between the Roman Catholic Church and Rome, you'd laugh at me, wouldn't you?
I certainly would.
Yeah, I mean, it grew right out of Rome. It was Theodosius that established it, and there was, at the time that Theodosius in 400 CE established it, there was 0 degrees of separation between the Roman Universal Church and an Imperial Rome.
Right. Tsars or papas.
Yeah. And it had nothing to do with Rome, the city, because Theodosius ruled out of Constantinople.
Right.
Rome, the city, at the time he did this, was in ruins.
Oh, yeah.
So it had all to do with the Roman Empire as opposed to anything else. So Roman Catholicism is the reincarnation. And it's not even a reincarnation because the old Roman Empire didn't die.
No.
It just was...
moved around a lot.
Yeah, it transformed into the Roman Catholic Church. That's really what happened, is the Imperial Rome morphed into the Roman Catholic Church. So if I tell you that the Roman Catholic Church is not Roman, you'd look at me like, are you nuts? If I were to tell you that that the Soviets during the time of the USSR We're not socialists. Would you think that I'd have any credibility?
No, I'd have to either straighten you out or ignore you.
All right, so when somebody says the Islamic State is not Islamic or tries to ignore the fact that you can't declare war on the Islamic State and say we're not going to tolerate violence against Islam, how is that any different?
You took a stupid pill.
You took a stupid pill.
Buddhists follow Buddha. They follow his eightfold path. He said, this is my way, follow the way.
Mm-hmm.
But they call themselves Buddhists.
Right. And so somebody that is practicing Buddhism, whether it is, you know, one, and there's a lot of different variations of it now.
It's morphed as all things do, but...
Right. They're Buddhists.
Mm-hmm.
So, how are we going to fight against the Islamic State if we're not going to fight against Islam?
Let me just say a quick here about fighting them.
Right.
I have a real hard time with the number of bombs and things that, and the number of years we've been at this.
Yes.
Thinking about the other day, I heard a report, and they took this little town, and they had 30 sorties. Now, I don't know how many bombs per sortie.
This is Raqqa?
Probably.
Yeah, Raqqa is the place they've been hammering recently.
Somebody, they just reported that last night we did 30 sorties, and I'm going...
And the Russians did about that many, and the French did about that many. And so, means there was about 100 bombing runs of Raqqa.
Okay, so if you did that on my little town, now I'm not allowed to have guns that they have. I have, we can shoot squirrels, but that's about it with our weaponry. But even if we had all their guns and 30 sorties came one night to my town, it would not only wipe out my town because of the strategic stuff of where I live, waterways, lakes, so forth, dams, it would wipe out 600,000 people would be devastated.
Mm-hmm.
It would be over for this part of Northern California.
Mm-hmm.
How many bombs does it take to wipe these people out if that was your goal? I mean, come on. We've got.
Have you looked at pictures of Aleppo or Homs or Raqqa or any of these towns, villages, and cities? Have you looked at pictures of any of them?
But obviously, it's not working to stop this. I mean,
So all we're doing is we're turning what was already a third world environment because they're impoverished by Islam.
Right.
So poverty was already reigned supreme. And in Islam, there is no appreciation of beauty or of quality of anything. So, I mean, I've traveled in these countries. I tell you, it's
nasty.
They were slums before we began this.
Yeah.
And now they're piles of rubble.
Yeah.
Now, I want you to tell me how that will do anything other than destroy, create refugees, and kill. And by the way, you know, when we were bombing in Vietnam, and the Viet Cong would point to those airplanes up there and above the villages that were dropping Agent Orange or napalm or other forms of bombs and said, whose symbol is on those airplanes?
Yeah, best recruiting tool you could get.
Absolutely. Do you think that the people of Syria are in love with America for having relentlessly bombed them?
Let me tell you something. We have a great example of that in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
It took 120 years before they stopped putting dam in front of Yankee.
Yeah.
They said Yankees. You know, the Southerners, they burned everything.
Right.
I don't care what your position is on the wars. All of them are bad.
Right.
But, my God, they wiped out, they burned the farms, they tore down the houses, they put a tax on them after they occupied them. Lost it.
In the South, it's called the War of Northern Aggression.
Yeah.
Nothing civil about it. No. And there wasn't anything civil about it. We celebrate this. America likes to celebrate its great war leaders, Ulysses S. Grant, who was a drunkard and a mass murderer.
Sure.
And Sherman and Lincoln, who was a avowed racist, and he has a temple built to him now.
Mm-hmm.
But no, this was despicable.
Sherman did the same thing to the Indians. It was the Indian solution.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Hello, kill all their food, and then kill, and then round them up.
Oh, yeah. America thinks that we were so great at liberating Europe, and you think of the cities that we firebombed.
Yeah. Look at the pictures.
Look at the pictures. And it's... It is astonishing, and what we haven't figured out yet is that you absolutely never win a war. You lose every war, everybody loses. And we have started these wars, you know, in Vietnam, where it's just a tragic loss of life. Everything in the Islamic world, a tragic loss of life, and the end result produces something that was worse than what you started with, for all sides.
Well, I looked at the pictures this morning of Paris,
mm-hmm.
and there was like 30 pictures or something, and 29 of them are of military occupation, and I'm talking
Correct.
Military, not policemen. I'm
Correct.
Talking military operation, they with weapons.
Yeah.
Of,
yeah.
My God.
Yeah, that's right.
They're
now,
not rifles, they are machine guns, and I'm sure they got grenades and everything else.
Oh, they are. They're throwing grenades, machine guns, 50-caliber sniper rifles. They're in assault carriers. Now, that's not to say that there aren't some people with police on their chest and the bulletproof vests and full wraparound helmets. But, you know, even the police were wearing the kind of black mask where only the eyes and nose are visible, the mouth and the eyes and nose. That the terrorists normally wear.
Well, I was going to say that, too. They everything you look, no matter where it is, because it's all coming, I guess, out of the same four or five factories,
mm-hmm.
and we're supplying it, is these people all look the same.
Right. They're all in their black gear, and they all look the same, no matter where you are around the world. And it, and the, they're, even in America, there used to be something that distinguished domestic law enforcement and federal agents, and then federal agents and the U.S. military.
Right.
But as you look at the pictures of America like this, like Boston after the Muslim bombings, or Paris now, what you see is that there is no distinction anymore. We have created this integrated, and in America it's George Bush's Patriot Act with the Department of Homeland Security that has brought everybody all together as one overly armed, overly equipped, overly violent, overly freedom-depriving group of goons. And that's what we have in America. And but what you've said here is that as a result of Europe being opening the doors to the deadliest disease man has ever conceived, Islam, that as a result of opening its doors, they were smitten by Islam. And so the response to that is more bombing of Islamic areas and Muslims, which will just make it worse, of course, send more refugees, more of the disease, and make them matter and help them recruit. But what did they do in their own country?
They turned to a military state.
Correct. You know, I have been enjoyed talking with IQ about what he considers is the last best hope. And he says that because of this onslaught of Muslims into Europe, that he thinks that that there is going to be anarchy and a revolution. And I agree with him on the anarchy. I don't agree with him on the revolution. He thinks there's a 1% chance that it's going to be positive for Europe, because, you know, they're just not going to tolerate this. There'll be enough good people that will take a stand. And I told him, no, it's not what's going to happen. What's going to happen is that Muslims are going to act like Muslims, so you're going to see a lot more terror. And the right-wing wackos are going to respond violently because that's all they know. They're not going to use their words and express condemnation against Islam. No, they're going to use their fists and weapons. And the government's going to impose a military state to protect the Muslims and to put down the right-wing extremists. And what we're going to have is military juntas in Europe. Now, they'll be under the guise of elected presidents, but it's going to be military, martial law, military rule. And that's going to happen. It's going to happen throughout Europe.
I can't see that it wouldn't be controlled by NATO and the UN type of thing.
Oh, well, ultimately, sure. I mean, the European Union is already a conglomeration of nations, but what we are witnessing in France, and people are acquiescing to it, you don't hear anybody say, good God, we just turned our country into a police state. And what do they do today? You know, they, in search for what they call the mastermind. And bull. I mean, there's no mastermind. Come on. You're talking about some crude suicide vests and some AK-47s, and they went into some, like, they wanted to go into the stadium, didn't get close to it. One of the suicide bombers outside of the stadium blew himself up and nobody else. And they, you know, to walk into a theater of unarmed people and to blast away at them, that is not a mastermind. I mean, so
that's a coward.
Oh no, this is just a cowardly scumbag. And so they want to find the mastermind. There's no mastermind. They're just Muslims acting like Muslims. And if you were to find him, so what? So what?
I have another thought, and bear with me here because this is dangerous. I'm thinking. All right. When I was in school, that's when health class we learned about AIDS and things like that. And we were told to that you can't tell who has AIDS and who doesn't have AIDS. So you're supposed to, every sexual partner, you're supposed to assume that they have AIDS. And you wear a condom. You know, they tell you these, they go through these things.
What do they say? Don't be a fool, wrap your tool.
Don't be a fool, wrap your tool.
Right.
So, now, can you tell me what the difference between an extremist and a non-extremist? Do they look different?
Oh, in terms of Islam? In terms of Islam, well, the idea of a non-extremist, a non-jihadist Muslim, is a myth. There is no non-jihadist Muslim. If a person's pretending to be, if a person says, I am a Muslim, and they're not a jihadist, they are, they're lying about their religion. That's just the bottom line.
I know that me and you know that,
right,
and that people listening know that. But what I'm saying is that if by their own logic, shouldn't we assume that everybody
When we invaded Afghanistan, and then subsequently invaded Iraq, it began 3,000 radio interviews for me. And at the inception of those radio interviews, I said the same thing universally, which is that you cannot send a military in to fight a civilian uprising, and that they're not going to wear uniforms. There will be absolutely no way to tell those who want you to be there, which will be very few, and those who would like to kill you, which will be very many. They all look the same. It was like Vietnam. You couldn't tell the difference between Viet Cong and South Vietnamese. They all look the same. And so how do you fight a war? How do you send men and women in to fight a war when you don't know if the person you think you're protecting wants to kill you, or the person you're trying to kill is seeking your protection? How do you do that? When you have a religion where the lone founder of that religion says it's appropriate, in fact, beneficial to deceive, to make the enemy, which would be non-Muslims, easier prey, how in the world would you go about determining who you can trust and who you can't trust?
You can't.
You can't.
You couldn't possibly be able to do it.
No. That's why you can't win this with bullets and bombs. You can't, you know, Syria's, you know, Syria was over 20 million people. How in the world are you going to be able to wage a war in Syria when there's 20 million people and there's no one wearing, the only ones wearing uniforms are the small number, very ineffective troops for Assad. And they're in the city-state of Damascus. Nobody else is wearing the uniform. How in the world are you going to tell who's who? We're going to use our drones and say, well, this person's a leader. and let's go after them. And how did that work out for us when we hunted down the leadership of Al-Qaeda? Didn't it just morph into another Islamic terrorist organization? Didn't change anything. Didn't change anything. But what's changed now, forever, is Europe. You know, this morning, in that raid, every news report says that armed men in flak jackets and helmets and assault rifles came in by the scores of truckloads. And this is a suburb of Paris, right by the soccer stadium. They came in, troops came in by the truckload, and there was constant gunfire for a period of almost 2 hours. That is the consequence. It's how America responded to the bombings in Boston. Glenn, it's this is what you predicted.
Well, I was concerned about things going cattywampus in the summer, but actually, funny you should say it that way, because it does have come to bear on why I called. Yeah. I can remember, Yada, in the early 1970s, taking the commuter train into Philadelphia, and the train right in front of the Reading Terminal train station down near City Hall. You mm-hmm. walk out of the train station, and there would frequently be, literally standing on a soapbox with a megaphone or a big amplifier speaker, a man dressed in a sort of an off-white colored robe with an off-white colored cloth cap, a black man mm-hmm. preaching for about Islam. We mm-hmm. had, during the days of Malcolm X and the Black Civil Rights Movement and everything, mm-hmm. we had a notable movement. I mean, this was a very small cadre of people, but it was a distinct racial synthesis between black militants and Islam.
Yeah, Nation of Islam is what it was called. Right. In fact, it still exists. It's very effective in the African-American community, even though it's essentially a gang.
Well, yeah, but to it, yeah, and I'm saying it's like a 14-year-old kid coming out of the train station. Sure. Like, who's this guy? What's he doing? And so, you know, and here in America, we have, you know, a slight difference in our difficulties with black-white racial tensions than in most European countries, you know, for obvious historical reasons. So when this when these refugees come here, mm-hmm. we're having these race relations issues. They're trying to trump up all this race hate here. Mm-hmm. When the migrants start coming here, are we going to have an alien synthesis once again of the, you know, black-white race relations issues and the Muslim-American race relations issues? And are, you know, are blacks going to tend to gravitate to Islam, you know, in this?
You know, it's the African American community is interesting. It's in terms of its religious perspective, there is a lot of racism. There's more racism, and you can see it in the faces and in the protests that African Americans are far more racist than our Caucasians. And it's just overwhelmingly so. And to pretend otherwise is to be in la la land. The African American racism towards other races, and it's not just Caucasians, is much more pervasive and deeply seated than Caucasian racism towards blacks. I'm not going to say Caucasian racism towards blacks doesn't exist, but far more people are like us. You know, Scott has many friends that are African-American, as do I. And, you know, in business, if two people were equally qualified, seeking the same job, and one of them was an African-American, I would hire the African-American over the Caucasian 100% of the time. And you say, well, you know, that's unfair. I'm saying if they, you know, I've hired thousands of people, so lots of times I've been in situations where two people for the job, from what I could tell, were equally qualified. I always chose the African-American. Always, 100% of the time. Because there was, for them to be properly prepared for that job, coming out of a community where they, in all likelihood, had inferior role models because of the fact that that a disproportionate percentage didn't come from a married environment where dad set an example or mom set an example of working. And so, it served me well. I mean, I got to know some really extraordinary, dedicated people of character as a result. But that's not the norm. And so, you know, as I look at these Black Lives Matter rally, I just see it as racism.
Right, but is you know, is Islam could, you know, like this Nation of Islam stuff sort of thing. I mean, blacks in America don't understand that in many other places in the world, the Arabic Muslims slaughter blacks.
Yeah. Did you see the?
They don't get that.
Right.
And, you know.
Yeah, that whole diatribe here recently we talked about on the show where it's a YouTube recording, so you can go see it and. I've forgotten the individual's name, but he's the primary spokesperson for the Nation of Islam today, and he was calling on 1,000 Muslims or 10,000. I think he was calling on 10,000 Muslims to go off and kill 10,000 Caucasians. And the audience first was about 80% black, and they were chanting him on. Yeah. There is an affinity. Now, one of the reasons an affinity is that racially, per capita, blacks make up a much higher percentage of the prison population. And in prison is you find the best recruiting ground for Islam because you've got a religion where the things that will put you in prison are celebrated: pedophilia, rape, stealing, fraud, lying, murder. All of those things are condoned and celebrated in Islam, so it certainly appeals to a prison population. So, yeah, I could see a lot of members of the African-American community align with Islam, but the patriarchs are primarily Baptist Christians.